What's up? Welcome to Sweathead. I've got Tom Morton, brand new, fresh US CSO of RGA. Tom, congratulations, first of all, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark.
We're going to talk about planning at scale today because for those who don't know, RGA is very scaled. It's large and it works with companies that are either trying to scale very aggressively or have also scaled and are trying to manage their scale while continuing to scale because scaling is what one does in America. Tom manages a group of over 60 strategists and 7 offices around the country. So we're going to talk about how to do planning with so many people in so many places with lots of clients. And we're also going to talk about, you know, how you develop a planning discipline or continue to develop a planning discipline in an agency where it didn't necessarily exist from the very start, which is common. I mean, any agency that's been around for 30 years, that's probably the case, especially outside of the UK. Tom, what I would like to ask you, because look, I'm 8 years into America and you've been here for quite a long time as well. How has your relationship with planning, the craft, how you see the role within an agency, your expectations of it as a discipline and how it connects to other disciplines, whether it leads, whether it follows, the dynamic that it has, its voice, its passion. How have you recalibrated all of those things through your time in America? It's a big question.
It's a big question. Well, let's start with a commonality. You and me both been in the US for 8 years. I first came to the US. I found myself working at Havas as the chief strategy officer. I found myself doing a startup in a brand consultancy and for the last 3 years at RGA. And what's interesting, looking at the role and the expectation of planning, I think what really changed was the space it was given. I grew up at BNP, which became one of the two founding agencies of strategy, now became Adam and Eve. And strategy had not so much a lot of space, but a lot of time to do its thing. You had months to discover things. And often you were coming back with ruminations or fulminations or something. It could encourage quite a contemplative style of strategy. And the interesting thing I think with strategy in the US is that the problems that brands face are exactly the same. It's entirely how am I different? What grounds can I win on? Who's my next wave of customers and how can I attract them? So all the same kind of problems, but just that need to be dealt with faster and with a more direct school of thought. So I think it's only really once I got to the States that I worked out you need some kind of discipline or some kind of mental model for how you solve problems, because you're going to need to fall into that very fast, because you're not going to get to do the walk around the garden path that some classic British strategy-based agencies like to do.
And where do you think that speed pressure comes from?
I think the speed and the pressure, it comes from corporate America. It comes especially from New York. I think American business culture is the most dynamic in the world. And that's because it's a culture that moves fast. It's a culture where speed to market is really important. And the business heroes are dynamos and doers. And that was true from the days of like Jack Welch at GE down to Apple and the decisiveness of people like Steve Jobs. It's not necessarily a business culture or corporate culture that rewards rumination.
Do you ever worry that the planning or strategy work can actually get in the way, that people can see it as a bit of an obstacle?
I mean, here's the thing. Ultimately, we're in service of clients, and we're here to help other people solve problems. And I think making room for strategy in the abstract is not necessarily a thing you could ever expect a client to do. I think where it can be difficult is if it feels like throat clearing or exploration. Nick Law, who was one of the founding figures here at RGA, we have Nike as basically our founding clients. And he used to joke that there are some strategists where if you hired them, you gave them a Nike brief, they'd always begin the brief with a reflection on how man learned to run in Kenya's Rift Valley for chasing gazelles. And while that was kind of true and poetic, it wasn't necessarily going to get you down to the essence of the problem. I think the art here is to get into the issue of problem solving much faster. No matter how much you want to write the poetry or the 30-slide keynote about, you know, how running developed in the Rift Valley, you might just have to hold off and not relish in the sound of your own voice and the ruminations of your own thought process.
Oh, to have had a classic education from Oxford and Cambridge and to be able to riff about such a thing, that would be an amazing thing to be able to do. How else have you had to recalibrate your approach and your energy around strategy in America?
This is the, I think this issue, it doesn't matter like where you started from or where you are now. We're now in a period of very fast business. We're in a period where we have a lot more data available to us and where the media environment that our idea is going to play out in has been like radically deconstructed. You know, a lot of it's been adjusting to that. I think years ago, there was a hierarchy in strategy. There was an idea that you worked above the line or below the line. And I think one of the things that I've loved about working in big agencies in the US is any big agency in the US will have strategists, it'll have connections or media people, it'll have analytics and marketing science specialists. And the magic when you can get it is when you achieve like a real parity of esteem between those different disciplines and you try and create something out of the fusion and the riffing and ricochet between those people. So that's been for me has been one of the joys, one of the moments of discovery, and I think one of the sources of power in, you know, at a time when a lot of the industry is deconstructing.
Mm-hmm. And then as far as, I mean, you work with massive clients, do they pull strategy from RGA in? Is it something that you have to try to fight for and establish on scopes?
It's an interesting thing. RGA's roots are in with project-based clients, and still to this day, 90% of our income is project-based. So scopes become very important. And I think the truth is the world is turning from an AOR model to a more project-based one. So I think the experience we have here has probably become quite applicable to more people working in strategy. Getting on scopes is always important. It kind of takes work. And I think the art of being on scopes is not because people should want you to be around because you're a good guy and it's nice to have your voice in the room. It should be, you know, it should be about because you're adding value, because you're going to discover things that are going to change the nature of the output. This is really where strategy needs to get its act together, is that strategy should be a discipline that changes what you make rather than that passes comments on what the organization was going to do anyway.
And how do you ascribe value to that? If it's a very, you know, it is a very executional market. I think part of that scale, part of its culture, it's that dynamism that you talk about, which is hugely positive in so many ways. And it's something that a lot of people move here or want to move to this country for. How do you ascribe value to planning when people don't always know what it necessarily is and when it needs to be very connected to some kind of output, when a plan is still always going to be distant to the output? It feels like a riddle. There's a good little riddle in there.
I think there is. I think it depends on how you deploy and how you build strategy. If you view strategy as the 10 slides before someone presents the work, then that's always going to be that your role is either as a garnish or as a ramp up or as some kind of unnecessary grandiosity before you get there. The point is, strategy is there to change things. The action standard for strategy is, did you find a new audience, a new way in, a new source of advantage, a new shape of work that's going to change what we do? And so thinking about everything that we do in service of those outputs, and thinking about those things as like positive outputs as well. I think one of the big things that we've learned from stepping into consultancy is you can turn strategy into a chargeable, valuable thing. Because it turns out being able to map how the world has changed, what are the vectors of change, and where your brand might have an advantage, that's a value. Mm-hmm. Finding the next wave of customers, rather than thinking about target audiences, thinking about who are the people who are within your reach, who will bankroll your future, and having a definition of those people, a persona of those people, a size and addressable way of finding them, that's really advantageous. These are things that even in like fast moving, I think I know it all, I think we've done the strategy internally, new economy clients, these are things that people genuinely value. Mm-hmm. And so I think kind of the productizing that media agencies have done in the past and that consultants are doing now, I think is something that general strategists are going to need to learn.
Right. And so you mentioned that strategy is there to change things. Is that something that you do measure or could measure on some kind of balanced scorecard? Like how many projects have come through strategy / planning? And then how many of them have led us to actually changing something?
This is something we're working on right now. Forgive a little digression into corporate speak. RGA is a company, our value proposition is transformation at speed. We will change you, and we will change you fast. There's a really interesting conversation that's going on right now about, well, what are the metrics? What are the benchmarks of that? You know, if increasingly there's this kind of binary in the kind of clients who are looking for agency help, there's those who are looking to change, there are those who are looking to keep the lights on, that we're going to need to have some kind of standards. And this kind of becomes doubly important when you're trying to work out why you need strategy or why you need multiple flavors of strategists. If we can set ourselves the action standard of did this change things? Did we come up with something new? That's what gets you invited. That's what gets you paid, and that's what gets you asked back.
Mm-hmm. So if RGA is about changing you and your business and changing you fast, you've been there for 3 years. How has RGA changed you?
How has RGA changed me? It's been a terrific experience because as a place, it's probably got the broadest range of talents of anywhere I've ever worked. Across the US, we're about 1,000 people. And within there, there are people who are experts at how to sell products on Amazon. There are people who are experts at chatbots. There are hundreds of amazing designers. There are so many people who are good at things that you're not good at. Collaboration is a very boring business word because short order cooks have to collaborate, rugby players have to collaborate, but the collaboration of like radically different disciplines coming together to make a new thing has been something that's changed me and something I've really appreciated. I think the other thing I've really appreciated is the type of brands that I've spent my time working on. Almost all the work that we do now is with new economy brands, companies from the digital age, or from established companies that have said that they want help radically reinventing. And what that means is you have to develop like a new strategy worldview, not so much based on, if you like, the good and best practices that came up from like packaged goods generations ago. You've got to develop like a new set of standards, a new way of, a set of brand considerations that apply just much more to these kind of connected world brands.
So I don't always dig into the company at which someone works, but obviously RGA is very well known. A lot of people would like to work at RGA or at least learn from it. So I've got some questions specifically about planning there. First of all, you've got over 60 strategists, right, in 7 offices. To whom do they report? What's the structure?
New York is a big old office. There's like 600 people here in New York. It's divided into 4 mega groups, each of which is run by an executive strategy director. In our offices in LA and Portland, Chicago, Austin, San Francisco, we have an executive strategy director. Basically, they look after their own pack of strategists, connections planners, marketing science professionals. So it ends up being, if you like, a bunch of multidisciplinary clusters with an executive director sitting on top of each one.
Mm-hmm. And how often do the senior people get together?
We get together regularly. There's lots of one-on-one check-ins just around the dynamics of the new problems we're trying to solve. Frankly, recruiting and talent is a very dynamic place. I think as a company, we onboarded something like 300 people last year. So there's a lot of that. A lot of the get-togethers that really matter are when we get together all the disciplines. Once you add together the extended family of strategy, the connections planners, the marketing scientists, the consultants, the futurologists from our content publishing hub, it comes out at like over 100 people. And getting those together, either like the constant banter of Slack or big all-hands sharing experiences, that's often where things are most powerful. Because it turns out that like, the diversity of expertise means that you can solve almost any problem and you can actually genuinely learn when you do listen and learns.
Mm-hmm. And with such a big company, do you have a program to advocate for strategy and planning, or is it pretty well entrenched, respected and wanted?
You're constantly evolving the discipline and you're constantly being useful. And I think rather than like advocate, I don't think it's necessarily a question of advocating for strategy. I think it's much more a question of developing our craft and developing our practice. Because, you know, frankly, if you do valuable things and you do new things, you will be more in demand. We're not getting together to prove our existence. We're getting together to polish our craft.
And then are there certain types of strategy projects, deliverables or activities that are more common in different parts of the US? Are regions different at all in their needs of strategy?
I'm not sure if there is necessarily a regional difference. I mean, the truth is we have a lot of West Coast clients just because we lean more to kind of technology and new economy companies. That's a constant need. There's no typical profile that you'd expect. I mean, LA, which you would expect to be, let's say, like, you know, a superficial entertainment office, actually turns out to have a real expertise in like audience and fan-based brands, and also incredible brand design practice. Our Chicago office, which usually Chicago offices are code for like heartland packaged goods type work, they do some of the most progressive work that we have. Most of our chatbot and AI expertise is in Chicago. So, you know, whilst the expertise varies by office, it absolutely doesn't mirror the cliches of the US map.
What about recruitment? You know, from what I understand, you're building a pretty diverse team of strategy people there.
Absolutely. Recruitment's been kind of exciting. I mean, the truth is that about a third of the strategists we have started work with the company in the last 12 months. And what we've really been looking for are basically very high impact people who think fast, because that's the speed that our clients work at, people who are like natural orchestrators, because we think most of the magic is going to come from the combination of the talents, and full of people who can solve problems at different altitudes. We talk a lot about what's the right altitude to solve a problem at, because we can do a lot of different things. Spotting whether clients really got like a membership problem, or a problem with finding a role in a changing world, or they've got a media problem, we can spot the right altitude. So people who can work at those different altitudes. We've had a lot of the best people we've hired have been like the token upstream person, or the token design person in another famous agency. And it turns out the thing that made them an outlier in their company makes them absolutely right and at home here.
I'd love to kick around that word altitude a little bit. I do think, hopefully not through podcasts and blogs and tweets, but I do think that some of us cherish this craft quite a lot. And with that can come the communication of idealism. Mm-hmm. I often get messages in the middle of the night, not just the middle of the night, but often in the middle of the night, where someone's recently joined an agency and they thought they were there to do the kind of strategy and planning that people who listen to this might think is what it's all about. And clients aren't having any of it. And so I like your metaphor of altitude. Can we just talk specifically about some problems? I know you mentioned a couple just there. What makes a problem too high in altitude?
If you look at the very top of the, let's say the very top of the mountain in terms of altitude, is how is the world changing and how do I need to change? That's like a really fundamental question that you can answer as a very good high-end strategist. It's something that sometimes an agency person is called to solve, sometimes a consultant is called to solve. Once you've cracked that, you know, what's my source of advantage? What's my role in the world? That kind of definition. And as you start ticking those things off, you start getting into, you know, have I got the right range of products and services? Who is my future user I should be chasing after? You know, have I got a way of talking to them? You know, am I using my media dollars in a way that fits my goals and how channels work? Have I got a playbook for showing up in social media? There are so many different altitudes. It's like you can start ticking them off. And the truth is, I think so often clients come to you and the problem they come to you with isn't the real problem. It turns out the actual problem is a couple of levels up. And so I think as a company, you have to decide that you want to solve that problem at a higher level. You need to have the capability. I think it's one of the challenges, if you're a very good strategist, is if you can spot the problems exist at a higher level, but your organization can't sell anything that would solve that, then your big picture thinking is turns out not to have a buyer. Yeah. And in the same way, sometimes I think you just have to acknowledge that it'll turn out that the client has solved a lot of their more fundamental foundational problems, and their problems are those of activation. And you know, we really need to find joy and use a lot of intelligence for working through things like, how do I show up in people's feeds? Yeah. Where in my user journey should I be? Have I started to turn my users into members? This is what I mean about the altitude, is spotting where the real problem lies and working out how far up or how far down you have to go to solve it.
Totally, totally. And just to put that onto a whiteboard for people who are maybe newer into a strategy career, sure. there is a technique which it's a little bit like the five whys from Toyota, but let's just call it problem behind the problem, where you might get a brief that comes in, you do some research, and then you decide, oh, well, the problem that came in is either a little bit shallow, not provocative enough, or you found something chunkier, and you might write that down at the bottom of a whiteboard or on a wall. And then you ask yourself, what's the problem behind the problem? What's causing that problem? And you write an answer to that. And then you ask, what's causing that? And then what's causing that? And then you go up and up and up. So on the one hand, Tom, you were talking that high altitude could also be existential, you know, like, what are we doing? What are we doing here? And what's the meaning of this brand when maybe they do just need a video or whatever they need? And then there's also just trying to use that very practical problem behind the problem exercise to visually create bottom to top, street level to mountaintop metaphor.
Absolutely. And then I think that becomes about the, that becomes about the capabilities of your company. That if you don't have, you know, if your relationships aren't at a certain level with the clients, or if you don't have a capability to solve at that level, the fact that you spotted the problem, the existential problem, is kind of academic, because ultimately it's going to come down to, can your organization make the solution? Can your client buy the solution?
Well, yeah. And I look, going back to the, one of the first questions about how you calibrated, I had to calibrate on that here too. I remember working with Silicon Valley companies and would do research. A problem would come in. I'd get on top of it. I wouldn't have met the client because it might have come through like without even touching planning, straight through an account person. And I might do a bit of research on a 1 or 2 page memo, and then I present it and they're like, no, we can't touch the product. We're marketing. And in my idealism about agnostic problem solving, I was like, oh.
And Silicon Valley is the place where that church and state divide between product and marketing is probably the strongest.
It is. It is. How do you deal with that? Because you've got clients over there. Did you pick up on that really quickly and early? That you just can't mess with the product and every question is a marketing question?
I think it then becomes a question of like who called you in. It becomes about working the relationship. It becomes about dancing with the partner who bought you. A venture capitalist describes Silicon Valley as large minds solving small problems. And there's a unique element of Silicon Valley clients where you're dealing with the cleverest and most ambitious people, and they've been hired, and their remit is very small. I think it's a really fascinating thing we find. I know there's been a bit of one-way traffic from agencies and agency strategists to going to the big four, big five tech companies. And you arrive and it turns out that you're going to work on a very, very narrow particular thing. It's been an issue recently. Some of our most recent hires have been boomerangs from Silicon Valley who wanted to go back and go back to agency world and solve problems at a wider level.
Yeah. It sounds like you're describing anesthetists, people who study for years and then they end up just sticking anesthesia in people and have probably the worst mental health from the statistics I've read of doctors. They're out. The life outcomes aren't always that good. I'll put it that way. You mentioned the need to think at speed. How can a strategist do good thinking quickly?
I think really, really unpacking the problem, the nature of the ask, becomes very important. I think so often we spend time wondering what the problem might be, or going off on some random exploratory hunts. Having a really good sense of like, what is the shape of this problem? What kind of problem does this look like? And therefore, what do I need to go and investigate and solve is a really good place to start. Mm-hmm. Nilo's strategy is essentially an assembly of truths that a brand can organize and decide around. Getting to that quickly becomes very important. So I think often like once you've found like a fundamental user truth, or even like there's a data point that is so glaring that you can't avoid it. One of the ways I've really found myself working since I got to the US, which is a more quantitative culture, find a data point or an evidence point that so clearly points to the answer that you can't avoid it.
And well, do you lead with it?
It certainly becomes a start point. I know one of the definitions I've heard of an insight is something that once you hear it, you can't unhear it. Mm-hmm. There are data points, there are evidence points that have that same kind of role, that same kind of illuminating role.
I think statistics and sentences that state statistics can be insights. Like, for example, from some behavioral economics papers that I dug up years ago on altruism, one thing that I read, I don't know if it's still true, don't know if it's been repeated, but one thing that I read is that couples who argue about how much to donate tend to donate more. That was quantitative, right? That's really interesting. And you could put a statistic in there, I'm sure. And that is, to me, that's an insight. But then you go, well, what's going on there? And then you start to look at the psychology of it and how the couples, yes, they're vested and they want to do good, but then one of them will donate more to spite the other person because they want to win. And so back to the point around altitude and going high with too high with the problem that you're trying to solve, an insight can go deeper and deeper and deeper. At some point, it's got to rest somewhere.
For me, this is where data points become very important. And I think as an industry where we have this kind of virtue signaling where we have to prove that like data is less important. There's a couple of examples of things I've worked on. Years ago, working with it was Coppertone suntan lotion. It turns out that half the search volume for suntan lotion and suntan things lands between Memorial Day and July the 4th. One way of looking at that data is that means that you could actually spend your entire media budget in 6 weeks of the year. So it doesn't matter if you've only got a $20 million media budget, because you've actually got a $3 million a week media budget, because you only have to come to life at that point. And I'm always wary of insights that are observations. Hmm. But once you've got something that turns into a decision function or allows you to double down, that becomes really important. We're doing some work last year with Samsung about the latest Samsung Note phone. And Note phones are basically productivity phones. And one of the issues that they had was they'd reached a point where these phones are largely... it's very hard to tell the difference from looking at it, how it's different from the previous generation. And so the problem they had was we have this incredibly high-performing, high-functioning productivity phone, and no one can understand it. And it was fascinating when you started to look at the data of who might care about this. It turned out that gamers are the one subgroup of people who will pay more for a product based on what's under the hood. And so we managed to relaunch the phone that had been a productivity phone into being a gaming phone. Hmm. And for me, the fact that there's one subgroup of people who are willing to pay more for this, and therefore we could concentrate all our resources on those people. You know, for me, that's an insight, because that's a revelation you didn't have before, and it's a thing that helps guide you. You know, I think all insights, all strategies are ultimately decision filters.
Mm-hmm. So with that Coppertone example, and you did mention the phrase an assembly of truths or a network of facts, there's all these philosophical terms coming together. For those online searches, what other data would you need to be able to think about putting all your money into that short-term period? Because first of all, you have to explore whether those searches have the intent to buy, and then the percentage of purchases that even happen online versus offline versus spontaneously at a beach, for example. So what other data would you need to assemble to be able to follow through on that hypothesis?
You'd probably want to look at the seasonality. Yeah, you'd want to look at the seasonality of sales. You'd also want to look at where your competitors are deploying their media. Because if it turns out that everyone else has had the same insight, then they'll be doing the same thing. And you need to flush out. There's always a yes, but. You know, it's sunny in California all year long. Yes, but. It turned out that no one else had acted on this. Hmm. If you've got a year's budget, but you can spend it over six long weekends, that's kind of powerful. Mm-hmm. I think this all comes back to this point about how can you have strategy that has impact in like a fast culture that doesn't necessarily care for it. If you can come up with a strategy that helps a company make a decision or helps a company double down, that can be, especially like hard-nosed commercial marketers, that's kind of valuable.
Mm-hmm. Why are you choosing the word double down?
I guess it's that fantastic Lawrence Friedman definition of strategy, which is about like finding a position from which you win. So basically deciding like if I deploy my resources here, will I be successful? Hmm. So doubling down becomes very important, because if you don't start making choices, you are talking to every sentient person 52 weeks a year, trying to solve every problem for them in every channel. And if you can start to make some choices about who you win with, what you're best at, what's your use case, who's next, those are things of genuine value.
I want to linger on the psychology of the phrase doubling down just for a second. I wonder whether you would use that in the UK. I wonder if that's a phrase that maybe you've written about it and thought about it and you've used that phrase a lot. Maybe other people are using it a lot. But the idea of strategy being not just something that can help people win, but doubling down is about winning big. Mm. And that is definitely a really powerful American idea.
It's funny you say that. I hadn't reflected on that before, but you're right. That those kind of like American sports and gambling metaphors, the truth is that the metaphors of British business are much more kind of nuanced, and the metaphors of America are much more binary and are about sources of victory. It's not up to American business to understand foreign me. It's on me to make myself understandable to American business.
Part of me doesn't want to make too fine a point about your choice of words there, but sometimes these words slip out. And like I said, you might use this phrase all the time. I don't know. But sometimes these words slip out, and hearing it from your voice and your accent, I was like, what? Doubling down doesn't feel, I know English people would use it, but that feel, and it just talks about winning big and the idea of strategy as a way to win big, which is what people are in business for in America. It's why people move to the country.
Absolutely. And so it should be. I think that this is one of the terrific things I think about working in, as a foreigner working in America, the attraction of like the scale, the gung-ho-ness, the commitment to winning. These are attractive things. These are things that anyone who thinks they're good should experience at some point in their lives.
Dig it. Where do you find new strategists?
Honest to goodness, where we often find them, we find them in prestigious competitors where it turns out that they are the outlier person. They are the person who was hired to be the upstream consultant in a company that only really cared about execution. They were the person who was put in the quote digital stream or digital department, but found they're working, they mainly wanted to work across the aisle with other people. It tends to be good outliers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, look, I've worked with some of your clients. I've interviewed people from RGA for jobs in the past. I don't mean this in any challenging way, but like, not all your clients want strategy, right? So how do you calibrate on that? How do you work out when to turn the thrusters on and to try to get strategy happening on a particular account? Because I do think some of the idealism that people who've grown up in other kinds of planning cultures can bring to any company in New York is they're like, okay, great, it's on. It's just on or off. We're just total. Everyone's getting total strategy, like total football from Holland, and it doesn't work like that. Not everybody wants it or needs it. How do you make it work? How do you work out who needs what when?
I can say this now from a 3-year perspective. RGA clients do want strategy. One of the big things I've been working on is helping us solve problems more upstream. And it's not necessarily proving the validity of my craft or a place on the scopes. It's actually proving that we can solve problems that clients find valuable. So we're at a point where our clients do want strategy, and it makes a real difference. And it wins us business and gives a differentiation. It turns out what they don't want is they don't want the performance of strategy. No one needs the 50-slide keynote about learning to run in the Rift Valley. What people do need is they were fast and fresh diagnoses of who is my next wave of customers, what is the most advantageous way to talk about this product, how can I take this brand, this technology to the mainstream, all kinds of advice about how to thrive in the connected world. People really want advice and problem solving. I think we just have to take it away from the performative beard stroking rumination of quotes planning.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you spend a lot of your career doing?
Ruminating and beard stroking. I got kind of lucky, which is that I spent most of my formative years were on really interesting brands like PlayStation and Virgin that didn't necessarily want ruminative strategy. They wanted like fast answers about how do I grow? How do I find the next wave? How do I explain my difference and my quirky product to a wider world? And I think I just got into the habit of solving like that.
Mm. You've used the word problem quite often. Is there ever a cultural aversion at work or with a client with that word?
I haven't found one. And I know there's this kind of rolling philosophical debate about would you rather work from a problem or would you rather work from an insight? And I've tried to avoid those kind of schisms.
For me personally, I find that the problem statement is the first insight. And then I think we've written pretty similar things. I try not to read too much about strategy from other people right now because I'm trying to write a big thing, a book. And every time I read someone else's thing, I'm like, ah, get out of my head. I find that the problem is the first insight, and insights operate like ideas. So these things are all very, very similar. They just have different effects and different language around them. However, I've also been in a lot of meetings where I've tried to use that word problem and have been cut off and told me that problems don't exist here. They're all opportunities. And I find that very difficult because I like to ruminate about the problem because often there's something really interesting in it.
Yeah. The problem doesn't exist is one of those kind of rhetorical defenses. And what people really mean is I don't want to explore this. It tends to be a fear of exploration.
Hmm.
that drives that.
Yeah, I find it a red flag for the possibility that we're just not going to have any intellectual chemistry at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a bad word. It's a useful, provocative, powerful word.
Yeah, it is completely. And it's kind of interesting, I think, because so many of the creatives that we're partnering up with at RJ are people who come from like design and UX backgrounds. Problem statements can be useful, especially if you've broken down a problem into like a component part that's most important to solve. Our creative directors are really still in search of insights. They are looking for, they're looking for truths to design around. One of the most revelatory things I did a couple of years ago for a talk at Cannes, I interviewed 100 creative directors and said, what do you want from the planners? And the overwhelming answer was, give me an insight, give me a truth about the product or the audience I didn't know before. And it was kind of interesting to just getting that. And it turned out that it was true across the digital agency and the Madison Avenue agency people and the Europeans and the Americans and the Australians. Truths I can build on are still a currency.
Yeah. And most of them will take it in a sentence or two sentences. Like, they don't need a page necessarily, although they will appreciate it because they want to see that some homework's been done. I mean, and at the same time, a lot of creatives are way capable of intuitively getting to their own problem statements and insights as well. Is there much free flowing between planners and creatives at RGA?
We've tried to create it. We've often done insight workshops. We call them 2x4. So it's four walls of inspiration, roughly four people, 2 hours together. And fundamentally, we're a culture of collaboration. It's a culture that believes that if you smush together people from different thinking backgrounds, you will create something new. That everyone's very happy to jam on the inside. So you very rarely meet people who are waiting to have it delivered when they could actually help work on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last topic. How does being CSO change your day?
I think when you step from being a strategist to being a manager of strategists, and then like you go into that the leadership of the company, the company becomes your client. I think that's the biggest change. It's the application of insightful strategic thinking to problems your company has.
And identifying those problems, is that something that happens in a formal way? Like, how are you going to break off that kind of work?
It just happens as part of that kind of calendared leadership day. You discover things that need solving or where you need to go apply your strategic skills. I think that this is the thing. Eventually, as a strategist, you're either going to, and these aren't binaries, but you're going to end up codifying how to solve problems. You're going to end up solving problems for the organization, acquiring the agency as your own client, or you're going to end up trying to solve things at a different altitude with your clients. And those are not bad end states.
Okay. And then last question. In years ahead, when you look back at your time at RGA, what do you hope you contributed?
I think there are two things I want to contribute. The first is to feel successful, I'd want to feel like I'd created a community and a culture, a self-sustaining one of really smart people who found joy in working together and solving new things. So I would like a people legacy. And at a really Napoleonic level, I'd love to codify or create the academy of how you build brands in the connected world. There have been great centers of excellence in past years. 10, 15 years ago, the great expertise was how to make a brand go viral. And that expertise lived at Crispin. Now, decades ago, the expertise of like how you stuck a personality on a brand lived at places like JWT, Leo Burnett, BNP. I don't think there is currently a great home for how to design and build the connected world brands. And at my most Napoleonic, this is what I hope to achieve at RGA.
Interesting. Well, congratulations.
That was confessional, wasn't it?
No, it was good. It was good. I mean, you know, hopefully everyone who works with you will listen to this and hold you accountable. I like that.
Let's find out.
Yeah. Congratulations on the promotion to US CSO. It's a very large title. And thanks for joining us today. I know you've got a busy day, a busy evening. Where can people find you on the internet?
Well, before we say that, I want to talk about my partner in crime on this. RGA is often a culture of collaboration. So my joint chief strategy officer is Jess Greenwood, and we work together as the Mulder and Scully of insight hunting. And I am very, very lucky to work with someone as talented, as interesting as Jess. anything that we achieve at the strategy in RGA, we're going to end up achieving as a collaboration.
You know what? I got one last question then. Why don't you think there are more partnerships like that at that senior level? Is it just too expensive? Is it egos? Is it because you add two strategy voices, then all of a sudden that dilutes the number of other disciplined voices? Why isn't that more common?
I think a lot of companies are organized as a pyramid structure. And I think RGA has always been a respecter of disciplines coming together. Look at our chief creative officers. You have Richard Ting, who is from an incredible design and UX background. Tiffany Rolf, who's from an incredible storytelling, innovation, brand redefinition background. And there's a belief that a breadth of talent will achieve more. If we can serve as a weird test case for how two different strategic people from two very different strategic backgrounds can come together and make something new, I'll be more than happy with that.
Awesome. Congratulations on the new role. And hang on, did I ask you where people can find you on the internet?
Absolutely. I am on Twitter at Tom Morton.
Once again, Tom, it's been wonderful hearing about your philosophy with Jess and everybody else at RGA about planning and strategy there. I know you're hiring, so people can look up the website and find roles there, I'm sure.
Oh, please do. Please do. Go to rga.com/jobs. We are hiring. We need you. We need the good outliers.
The good outliers. I like it. Thank you so much for joining me on Sweathead today, my man.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, peace.